there for a minute. But. Do I need to do a mic check? Check, check. Shibboleth, shibboleth. Okay. So I'm a little bit technologically challenged this evening. The Bible app that I usually have on my Amazon Kindle isn't working the way it should. So I ask your patience a little bit. So part of the reason this board is out here is because I'm a doodler, and that's just me. That's just the way it is. So this is an incomplete list of the Proverbs of Washington. And there are rules that you have to keep in mind to keep your mind in Washington. And this is not the authoritative list. This is just the first three. In my list, and for those listening to the recording, the first proverb of Washington is "Never mind the hypocrisy." The second is "Now is never the right time," and the third is "Questions are for dopes." So I'm sure that you've seen a number of high and elected officials be asked from time to time certain things, and they always give the answer to the question they wish had been asked instead of the question that was asked. So we are beginning tonight a study in the book of Proverbs, and the book itself tells you in three different sections, in chapter 1, verse 1, in chapter 10, verse 1, and in chapter 25, verse 1, that what follows are the Proverbs of Solomon. And in chapter 25 and verse 1, it says, "The Proverbs of Solomon, which the men of Hezekiah transcribed." And then when we get to chapter 30 and verse 1, it says that they are the words of Agur, the son of Jake. Apologies for any mispronunciation. And then in chapter 31, verse 1, the words of King Lemuel, which his mother taught him. As I've been looking through this book and this compendium of pithy sayings and wise sayings and good advice, and inspired advice, it got me to thinking about the household, the family environment, the social situation in which Solomon would have grown up. Because he makes a plea repeatedly for his advice and for his proverbs, for his his counsel to his son to be heeded, to be obeyed, to be followed. And so there's a notation in my Bible, which I have left at home, that Solomon was born in approximately the year 990 BC. That's a notation in my Bible next to 2 Samuel 12 and 24 that mentions the birth of Solomon. So that year, if it's accurate, puts him at about 18 years younger than David's oldest sons, oldest children. And that means that Solomon would have been a toddler right around the time of the incident of Amnon and Tamar, which went unaddressed by King David, and which David's son Absalom, you know, took action in the absence of David's authority and leadership to address that situation. And I just there isn't a lot to go on in terms of what the daily interaction of Solomon and these other children of David would have been. What was the physical proximity? Was he in a different area? Was he in a different part of the palace? And it just got me to wondering too about the kind of relationship that David and Solomon had, since it ultimately fell to Solomon, who was about in the middle of the number of children, the number of sons that that David had. So, what was that relationship like? And there are some insights that we can glean on that. If we go to 1 Chronicles and chapter 28. So 1 Chronicles So if you look in verse 9, so this is part of, I guess I should back up a little bit before we go to verse 9. When you're reading through Chronicles, which is kind of a retelling of all of Israel, and you get to the passage about David, starting in in chapter 22, the handover of authority, it's tempting to have this impression, oh, okay, well, it's about to go from the death of David to the handover of the kingdom to Solomon, but there's this extended kind of treatment about David's handing over the kingdom and the plans for the temple and so on to Solomon. And so if you look in 1 Chronicles 28, verses 9 and 10, it says, "As for you, my son Solomon, know the God of your father and serve him wholeheartedly and with a willing mind. For the Lord searches all hearts and understands every intent of the thoughts. If you seek him, he will let you find him. But if you forsake him, he will reject you forever. Consider now, for the Lord has chosen you to build a house for the sanctuary. Be courageous and act." And if you go down to verse 20, it says, "Then David said to his son Solomon, 'Be strong and courageous and act. Do not fear nor be dismayed, for the Lord God, my God, is with you. He will not fail you nor forsake you until all the work for the service of the house of the Lord is finished." So what is that reminiscent of? David's charge there to Solomon. Be strong and courageous, excuse me. Makes you think about Joshua. Come on up, Danny. That's where I was going with it. In Deuteronomy 31 and verse 6, as Moses is wrapping up his series of messages, as the people are preparing to enter the promised land, the land that has been promised, the land that they've been thinking about and waiting to enter for many years of walking around in the wilderness. Moses says he writes in Deuteronomy 31:6, "Be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid or in dread of them. For the Lord your God is the one who is going with you. He will not desert you or abandon you." And then in Joshua chapter 1 and verse 9, well, even before that, starting in verse 6, the Lord says to Joshua, "Be strong and courageous, for you shall give this people possession of the land which I swore to their fathers to give them. Only be strong and very courageous. Be careful to do according to all the law which Moses, my servant, commanded you. Do not turn from it to the right or to the left, so that you may achieve success wherever you go. This book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate on it day and night, so that you may be careful to do according to all that is written in it. For then you will make your way prosperous, and then you will achieve success. Have I not commanded you? Be strong and courageous. Do not be terrified nor dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go." So I don't think, I don't think that the exchange between David and Solomon, as David is giving charge to Solomon, that was the only time that they ever talked. And it's clear that David, in hearkening back to those ancient words from Moses, and which were also passed on to Joshua for his term of leadership, that was a kind of a summary of the instruction that David would have given to Joshua. And furthermore, there's a tiny indication in 2 Samuel 12 about the birth of Solomon that the prophet Nathan had given Solomon a different name, Jedidiah, which means beloved of the Lord, which is an indication. How strong an indication? I'm not sure I would say, but it's an indication of the affection that the prophet Nathan had in towards Solomon, and might have had a role in his upbringing, and further reinforced the kinds of teachings that David was making reference to by telling Joshua to be strong and courageous. Let's see. And we know that Solomon was a man of considerable talents and energy. He knew a lot. He knew how to do a lot in terms of building, in terms of mining, in terms of ruling and making judgments among the people. And that got me to thinking a little bit about the limits of human knowledge and human understanding and human observation. There are lots of recommendations and appeals for for us, whether in government, whether in business, whether in life, to trust the science, to look to science. And that is fine, but I guess my, you know, cautionary note concerning that is to leaven all of you, any assertions you might make about science, any assertions you might make about knowledge, with some humility against the backdrop of the history of the frontiers of human knowledge being in motion all the time. I was recently reading a book that talked about the Earth-centric view of the universe, which reigned supreme until a Polish mathematician who worked in the Vatican came along and said, well, maybe the sun is in the middle of things. And he was making that claim on the basis of his observations, which were refinements. Anyway, it's a really good book. I'm not doing it justice up here. The book was also called The Discoverers, and it was also talking about how different civilizations over time had different numbers of days in the week. We tend to look at Genesis and say, well, okay, this was how creation was laid out in 7 days, and we understand about the Sabbath, and the Sabbath was a sign of the covenant, which God kind of underscored with Moses as Moses was going down the mountain. But not every civilization had a 7 day week. The Egyptians were experimenting for a long time with 5 day weeks. And so maybe coming out of Egypt, the Israelites had in their minds a 5 day week and had to have that corrected. So, but that's not the that's not the kind of knowledge that Solomon is stressing in these proverbs. That's not the kind of knowledge that he is encouraging his son to pursue. Let's see. The preamble in the preamble to the book, for the book, is outlined in chapter 1, verses 1 through 7. To know wisdom and instruction, to discern the sayings of understanding, to receive instruction in wise behavior, righteousness, justice, and integrity, to give prudence to the naive, to the youth, knowledge and discretion. A wise person will hear and increase in learning, and a person of understanding will acquire wise counsel. To understand a proverb and a saying, the words of the wise and their riddles. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Fools despise wisdom and instruction. In light of that, and that, and since that expression comes up periodically and from time to time in the book of Proverbs, what would be a good understanding? What would be a good working definition of that expression, the fear of the Lord? What do you think about that? Okay, of who God is.
It's an understanding
of who God is. So there may not be terror, to pick on that word, but isn't there a little bit of fear? Fear?
Yeah, it's an understanding that
fear
is so much greater than
me.
Right. Tony,
please. When you look up the word, in this case, it talks about terror and everything there. So, you know, I think when the term fear is used, sometimes there are different words, and sometimes it's talking more reverence or, you know, but in this case, that word is more fear than anything else. So, But I think the key there is not a fear of where we're going to be frozen and scared and not do anything. It's going to be a fear that leads to understanding and causes us to say, okay, because I understand who God is, I need to know what He wants me to do. But it starts with a fear that if I don't do it, there are going to be consequences.
Consequences of not
heeding the instruction from God. Did you have your hand up, Brad? Okay.
There was no thunder.
Okay. Okay. Pitter patter, maybe. All right. Okay. Any other thoughts about the fear of the Lord? I like what you're saying there. There are consequences to certain actions, and there are consequences for inaction. So there could be excessive exposure in that particular physical example you're talking about. Wait.
Going back to some stuff that Millie was saying, in the context of the verse, it really is about humility. That some people, the fool, will not be instructed. They're wise in their own eyes. They can't imagine that anyone smarter than they are, and more authoritative than they are. And so why would I be instructed by God or by anyone? Whereas if that's your position, you will never attain knowledge. Because at the heart of getting out of your ignorance is recognizing that there's someone wiser than you are. And recognizing that being is God. Because He created, brought all these things into existence. Is greater than you, and you can't humble yourself to acknowledge that, then you have no hope of ever having wisdom or knowledge.
Thanks for bringing that up. I was reviewing some of the book of Job, which is also part of the wisdom literature, and you know, in some of the latter chapters of that back and forth that he's having with his three friends and ultimately four friends. In chapter 31, Job lists the kinds of actions, the kinds of behaviors that characterized his life, and it's cast in this sense of, if I lack something, if there's something I still need to learn so that this relationship that I thought I had with God is not severed, or, you know, on the contrary, could become stronger, then I want to know what that something is. If I've got something that I still need to learn that is keeping me from being where I need to be with God, then I want to learn what that is. And that's emblematic of and illustrative of wisdom literature. To provide instruction on, to provide advice, examples, stories about not just how to live smartly, but how to live well, particularly with respect to God's will and God's ways. You know, something I came up with, which is kind of embedded in here. I hadn't thought of it in quite these terms about consequences, but just, you know, a sort of trembling understanding of how much God hates sin. And as we get into some of the chapters next week, particularly chapter 6 and chapter 8, there's some explicit listing of the things that God hates, and they're kind of all-encompassing things there. All right. Well, we've touched on this a little bit from question two. So what is the kind of wisdom that is being emphasized in Proverbs? And I gave a reference to an entry in the Strong's Concordance, H2451. I hope I didn't mistype that in there. But the Hebrew word is chokmah. Sometimes it's written with a ch instead of an h or a kh, which is translated as wisdom. But what kind of wisdom? Can we try to unpack that a little bit? The wisdom that Solomon is urging his son to find and pursue. Any takers?
That particular word carries with it this idea of skill. And so the usefulness and the same word that's translated when people are creating things for God's temple and things like that, because you have skills to produce it from the bar. So that word is used for wisdom.
Right, the verses that I put there are from Exodus 28, 31, and 35, from those three chapters. Those are words where God is giving instruction to Moses, and he says, I've given people a certain chokmah to be able to work gold, to work fabric, to work structures. So it's skill, and that's a good word. And I was just going to maybe add to it, knowing what to do and when. So it's not just a matter of passing along something for the son that Solomon is addressing, something to be memorized, something to be learned by rote, even though what I'm told by certain commentaries is that Proverbs is written in this poetic and easy to remember staccato short verses sort of style, but the idea is for the instruction to be internalized. And it got me to thinking about an expression I heard a lot in the military, particularly by my friends who were in the infantry. They said, if you want an operation to be successful, if you want to be successful in a certain task, you got to get your mind right. And that's an expression that was resonating with me. Perhaps I need to be corrected on that. But that's the sort of mindset, heart set that Solomon wants to impart to his son, and that he wants his son to cultivate, not just knowing the Ten Commandments, not just knowing the plagues, but taking in that instruction, that information, and using that to guide life and to guide his way of thinking, and to guide his treatment of others and how he conducts himself going forward.
So
please.
Knowledge and understanding and the ability to apply it.
Right. Yes.
Chapter 2 talks about how, okay, guys, we're being skilled. And we said, you receive my words and treasure up my commandments, receive them, treasure them, honor them. And then you go down to like verse 9, it says, then you will understand righteousness and justice and equity, every good path. For wisdom will come into your heart and knowledge will be pleasant to your soul. Discretion will watch over you, understanding will guard you. I think it's, you know, kind of interesting, especially for our times, that the wisdom of the Lord is the heart of understanding of these truths that are important to mankind, such as righteousness, justice, and these things that.
Not just lofty, highfalutin concepts, but a way of living, a way of behaving. Righteousness, justice, integrity.
It reminds me of the New Testament where it talks about becoming a mature Christian helps you discernment between good and evil. It takes the wisdom of the maturity of a Christian to have a discernment about the pathway that you're following, the pathway towards one direction or another.
To be able to understand the difference between good teaching and bad teaching, righteousness versus wickedness, knowing when you're straying from the path that God intends us to walk. And to that point, which kind of gets into question three a little bit, I think that the point you've brought up walks in the direction of helping one another in community, in the society of believers, because we can easily tell ourselves in our echo chamber that we're fine, right? And then before we know it, we're in a judge's downward spiral, you know, to borrow an expression, because we've wandered and strayed so far that we don't even recognize that we've done so. But if there's this, you know, if you're working on wisdom and I'm working on wisdom and we have a commitment to God that we share together and we're trying to keep each other accountable, then I think we do a service to God and to one another by challenging one another from time to time. Maybe that's not the right word, challenge one another, but we need to. I think there's a certain urgency toward encouraging one another in love to stay on the path and have enough bravery to be able to say, I'm not sure that what you're practicing is right. I had written down something before. So, you know, a cheap conclusion about the application, about knowing what to do and when to do it, is I need grace because I'm continuously working on myself. So don't judge me. But maybe a more valuable conclusion would be, let's work on this together. I'll help you stay on the straight and narrow. You help me to do the same. It's possible, because it's possible to be so heaven-focused that we do no earthly good. So we need to be working on keeping our eyes on heaven and doing some good here under the sun, but not limiting ourselves to life under the sun. And that's encroaching on who's teaching Ecclesiastes later on in the year. All right. Okay, let's see. How does wisdom from God serve as a shield to those who walk in integrity? From Proverbs 2 and 7. How does it serve as a shield?
Well,
to those who walk in integrity? Are they impervious to danger or disease? Of course not. Not in this life, but in the next life, that integrity, the application of that integrity, being mindful of place and role and having some humility will allow someone who abides by the wisdom from God to live with Him eternally. And so in an ultimate sense, even if not in an earthly sense, not during this lifetime sense, wisdom from God shields those who walk in integrity by serving as a kind of defense and guarantee of living with God eternally. Yes, please.
That question made me think about something that Moses said to the Israelites when they were about to enter the land of Canaan, and he speaks to them, and it's recorded in Deuteronomy. And so in Deuteronomy chapter 6, in verse 24, he says, "So the Lord commanded us to," and I think this is applicable to us as well, mm-hmm. because it's Moses and all the different, you know, relationship, I guess, with God. "So the Lord commanded us to observe all these statutes." So I think that gets to the point of wisdom and skill and knowing what the Lord is. He goes on to say, "To fear the Lord our God," so that is sort of the point we're talking about, from fear, "for our good always." And so, you know, I think that's important to keep in mind, that yes, God has a will, and it actually is for our good. And so for us to know what His will is, and to have the, there's a lot of attitude that's involved here that we've been talking about and touching on as well, is that humility is what you pointed out, and it's not just the knowledge of what His will is, but actually having that motivate what our behavior is. Because as James wrote, yeah, the demons believe and they fear, but they're obviously not the same right relationship with God. So as far as how that serves as a shield, I think it's because, you know, everything that God has told us to do is for our good and to protect us from danger we probably don't even know about.
Good point. Thanks. Thanks for that. Okay. Please.
Chapter 3, verse 5. When he says, "Trust in the Lord with all your heart, do not lean on your own understanding." The word "trust" there, when I understand the word, it's fall on your face. Before the Lord, with all your heart. Which is back to the end. And then, don't lean. We need help standing. We need to understand that He is not man. And He knows. And He will be our shield in that way, I think, if we. We understand He is compared to myself, and that I can't fix anything for Him, and I don't know everything, then He will shield me. Like you said, we're not oblivious, but we understand who He is compared to us.
Good. Thank you. Thank you for that. Any other comments on my point? Yes, please, Joe.
Just in verse 8 of chapter 2, it says that He, the Lord, guards the paths of justice and preserves the way of the saints. And then going down to verse 11 of the same chapter, it says, "Discretion will preserve you, understanding will keep you to the word." So I think in verse 8, you know, the Lord is with us, and He's with you, and with the saints, He's with those who are walking. So we're not on this, kind of going back to what he said. But conversely, he's saying that He guards the paths of justice. So He's there to protect us. And so I think, and to some sense, that, you know, that's what's kind of being, you know, talked about in verse 7. I think that we should take confidence in that. The Lord is with us and protects us from all the things around us.
Okay. We'll have that be our final note. Thanks for your attention. Thanks for the good comments. Appreciate it. Thank you.